The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. The Time Magazine edition that I'll be reading from today is the same as the one from last week because it's a double issue, January 18/January 25, 2021. It's bordered in the red of the Time Magazine tradition. It says the year ahead in white bold lettering above the very large block printed Time in white superimposed upon a background that looks like a grayish-green lab wall. And the people who predominate the cover are BioNTech co-founders Dr. Ugur Sahin, who's a man, and Dr. Ozem or Ozalem Turechi, and that's a female, in the headquarters of the BioNTech in Germany, January 3. The gentleman and the lady are both wearing white lab coats, and on the front of them is a label saying BioNTech. And the man's says Professor Ugur Sahin, and the woman's, I presume, although it's blocked by the black lettering of the Time Magazine cover, is Dr. Ozlem, O-Z-L-E-M, Turechi, T-U-R-E-C-I. His name is spelled U-G-U-R-S-A-H-I-N. And that photograph is by Drew Angerer of Getty Images. Beginning with For the Record today, one page of a few snippets, actually. I'll be fierce for all of us, for our planet, and all of our protected land. A quote from Deb Haaland, H-A-A-L-A-N-D, U.S. Representative, Democrat, New Mexico, in a December 19 speech after her nomination as Biden's Interior Secretary. If confirmed, she would be the first Native American cabinet member. Who is to say what you were allowed to absorb and not absorb growing up? A quote from Hilaria Baldwin, responding to criticism she had appropriated a Spanish identity and heritage despite having been born in Boston, in a December 30 interview with the New York Times. 144, the number of women serving in the 117th Congress when it began January 3, the most in U.S. history. Good news, South Dakota paramedic Robbie Vargas Cortez revealed an engagement ring taped to his arm as his now fiance, nurse Eric Vanderlee, prepared to administer a COVID-19 vaccine to him. 57, number of vials containing over 500 doses of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine allegedly left out of cold storage deliberately by a Wisconsin pharmacist, who prosecutors said January 4 believes the vaccine is not safe for people. I believe that individual is now a former pharmacist, having lost his license to practice. The overall impression is of a depressed and sometimes despairing man who's genuinely fearful about his future. A quote from Vanessa Beretzer, British district judge, in a January 4 ruling rejecting a U.S. extradition request for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Today he broke my life again. Mohammad Kinani said this December 23, after President Trump pardoned four men convicted of killing his 9-year-old in Baghdad in 2007 as Blackwater security guards. Because this is America, the 82-year-old hands that used to pick someone else's cotton went to the polls and picked her youngest son to be a United States senator. That was stated by the Reverend Raphael Warnock during his January 5 victory speech after defeating incumbent GOP Senator Kelly Loeffler in a special election in Georgia. This article entitled Time Off, it's an essay, The Escape Economy Around the Corner by Janice Min, M-I-N. This is the Time Off opener. In the dark days after 9/11, dire pronouncements about our nation's new cultural identity rained down like the acrid particles floating over lower Manhattan. It would be the end of irony, the end of comedy, our sense of innocence, particularly for Gen X and millennials who largely had known lives of peace and security, was gone. Hello, fear. R.I.P. fun. Yet months later, The Bachelor debuted on ABC. Shortly after came American Idol, then Joe Millionaire, a preposterous real-life acid test to shame gold-digging women. The show garnered 35 million viewers for its finale. Cynicism did not end. It took steroids. Nowhere was that more manifest than in an obsession with celebrity that would come to define the decade. I was the young editor-in-chief of U.S. Weekly from 2000 to, maybe that's Us Weekly, the S is not in caps, Us Weekly, from 2002 to 2009 as that publication covered the frothy zeitgeist as the soap operatic lives of young stars who needed only one name, Brittany, Lindsay, Jessica, became American obsessions. At its peak, Us Weekly was read by 14 million young, educated people a week, and I often thought about why we lusted for that escape. If 9/11 taught us anything, it was to be suspicious, unsettled. Danger lurks everywhere. An anxious public fled into alternate realities of no actual consequence. The Hills? Anyone? Hollywood shows like The Simple Life made it easy. Americans cultivated a metallic taste for zero-sum equations, a world of winners and losers in politics, foreign policy, and, yes, entertainment. Loving to hate Heidi and Spencer, Spidey, it turned out, was a lot more fun than trashing Rumsfeld and Cheney. Chumsfeld, anyone? Should J-Lo and Ben get married? Ask CNN, whose anchors devoted whole segments to the couple. Our escapism was apolitical and banal, but the effect in some ways was not. The aughts may have been the last time wide swaths of Americans shared a communal language, chugging from the same water cooler. Soon, social media and algorithms would splinter us into a million pieces. Today, the teens and 20-somethings who binged Gossip Girl and Survivor are in their 30s and 40s. Having matured in the shadow of one trauma, many will craft the aftermath of another, the 1918 flu, the Depression, the World Wars, and 9/11 all resulted in entertainment booms. The difference today is that Hollywood's in chaos, some say decline. As production ground to a halt and advertisers fled in 2020, corporate overlords right-sized organizations to streaming-first orientations. The pandemic has resulted in hundreds of thousands of jobs lost. Box office revenue is at a 40-year low. Content is now in the hands of streaming services, not the studios. But Hollywood's endemic woes have not altered people's appetite for TV. Our televisions are today's constant companion, bringing us Tiger King and eerie fan-free sporting events. Sure, we fantasize about post-vaccine trips we'll take, parties we will attend. Yet the truth is the bulk of our free time, on the other side, will be spent right where our lockdowns began, on a sofa in front of a screen. But what will that entertainment look like this time around? First, our escapist fantasies are different now. President Biden talks about one America, not blue states and red states. In another era, this might sound corny, but conflict has depleted us. We used to cancel subscriptions and TV shows. Now it's people. No surprise, many of the new shows that resonated last year, Emily in Paris, Ted Lasso, The Queen's Gambit, represented a new modern fantasy where essential goodness is celebrated and rewarded. Think anti-heroes to the previous decades, Don Draper and Walter White. Watching these shows last year delivered temporary inoculation against toxicity. Look for more of this kind of escapist programming, from high art to treacle. Feeling good will be the new Breaking Bad. Second, Hollywood's executive purges will change content. Old Hollywood is a club of largely white men who, like the U.S. Senate, serve continuous terms stretching into decades. Millennials and Gen Z, diverse and woke, are the Bernie Sanders, AOC spoilers, forcing a reckoning with uncomfortable truths. Pretty Woman romanticizes sex trafficking. Indiana Jones employs racist stereotypes. Plenty of Hollywood's legacy product has not aged well, and neither have its executives, whether ousted amid clouds of sexual impropriety, NBC Universal Vice Chairman Ron Meyer, or alleged racism, NBC Entertainment Chairman Paul Telege. Fortune 500 companies employed basic diversity and inclusion initiatives for years for consumer optics, and also because better profitability resulted as American demographics shifted. Uncomfortably, Hollywood always resisted doing the same, even if it hurt its own interests. One recent study revealed that diverse casts in movies significantly improved box office receipts. Now with a gun to its head, namely Twitter, and social movements too powerful to ignore, entertainment's corporate behemoths finally got the memo. In 2020, Netflix put Indian American Bela Bajaria as head of global TV. Channing Dungey, a black female executive, brought much-needed representation when she was named chairman of Warner Brothers Television. C-suites finally are cracking open beyond white guys named Alan and Bob. Third, the A-list is endangered. Hollywood recently erupted in outrage when Warner Media CEO Jason Kilar announced he'd be putting the studio's biggest tent poles concurrently in theaters and on its own HBO Max, breaking the tradition of windowing, where movies get first a theatrical run. Kilar is betting on two truths: that technology almost always wins, as does the buyer holding the purse. The powerful talent agencies at CAA and Endeavor have lashed out against the move, but the emotion is more fear than anger. The entire business model of stars, whose eight-figure paychecks are funded by $100 million to $150 million productions, with theatrical back-ends for top talent, is threatened. TikTok's top creator, Charli D'Amelio, just scored a family reality series on Hulu. Open a different app and you have Oscar winner Nicole Kidman on HBO. As streamers make even more shows to compete, the star power of any one actor is naturally diluted, and TV paychecks, for most, are nowhere in the same stratosphere. Expect the same stars who preach equity on their social media to feel it firsthand as the notion of a top-down A-list continues to erode. Fourth, plurality is the new mass. While the old ad model of cable and broadcast TV supported mostly white family in front of the TV hits. 76 million watched Seinfeld's finale. Netflix, with infinite cloud data and ambitions, programs 24/7 to every demographic nook and cranny. A black 30-year-old, an Asian teen, a white boomer, all have equivalent market value because everyone's a prospect who might pay $17.99 a month, all without heed paid to the idea of prime time for an advertiser-selected demographic. Disparate audiences are identified and served via algorithm and then stitched together for scale. A global marketplace also has taken subtitles out of the art house, as Nordic crime dramas, Korean soap operas, and Spanish bank heists enter our living rooms. Whatever your fancy, there is a show for that. Last, Carpe Diem time is coming. The French dubbed the decade after the 1918 flu the Année Folle. A-N-N-E-E-S space F-O-L-L-E-S. The crazy years. Radio, movies, parties, fashion, dance, and jazz flourished. Now, a full century later, the quarterly UCLA Anderson forecast expects a similar redux. With a vaccine and the release of pent-up demand, the next few years will be roaring as the economy accelerates, wrote Leo Faler, a senior economist with the forecast. Live entertainment and Broadway were already on the upswing pre-COVID as people craved IRL experience amid on-screen culture. The adage, you can't download an experience, will be especially apt as we emerge like restless horses in the gate from our almost Amish existence of baking bread and playing board games. Pre-COVID, live music was growing year over year, with $24 billion in ticket sales expected in 2022. Music festivals like Coachella already were the currency of Instagram and are only likely to come back bigger. In other words, expect the flex to keep going. Upon writing this piece, I looked up the definition of entertainment in the Oxford Dictionary. The action of providing or being provided with amusement or enjoyment. Are you ready? Truthfully, it sounds pretty good. Min, the writer, is a former co-president of Hollywood Reporter Billboard Media Group and is a contributing editor at Time. Time off. Pop Culture, Art Can Breathe Again by Judy Berman. Do you remember how it felt to be alive November 9, 2016? If you spent the day in a big U.S. city where overwhelmingly liberal masses lived, crushed up against each other with no room to escape the ambient mood, you might never forget it. Residents trudging around silent, sleepless, dead-eyed, as though something had siphoned off all their serotonin. After the initial shock, conversations turned toward potential silver linings. Hey, wasn't adversity supposed to be good for art? Certainly Trump would deliver plenty of fodder for late-night hosts and punk bands. Shortly after the election, New York Magazine art critic Jerry Saltz wrote, Trump's victory is a crucible of possibility for a new generation who will do what artists have always done in times like these, go back to work. There wasn't much evidence to support this gallows optimism even then. Pre-election pop culture had offered cartoonish Trump effigies. The spectacle of Alec Baldwin puckering his lips on Saturday Night Live and Cheeto epithets sprinkled like so much orange dust. You could argue that for art, the first casualty of the Trump era was subtlety, but it would not be the last. The arts have suffered mightily with Trump in the White House. While his policies have made it harder to subsist as a creative professional, his dominance over the public sphere has distracted artists from their work and audiences from their engagement with it. Put simply, Donald Trump was bad for art. To begin with the obvious, Trump lashed out at the arts and their practitioners, including Meryl Streep, Robert De Niro, and John Legend, among others. More damaging have been his attempts to defund arts institutions, such as the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which helps fund PBS and NPR. His agenda may have indirectly hurt private arts funding, too, as liberals opened their wallets to the ACLU instead. Then came COVID-19, which largely because of the Trump administration's disinformation and neglect has hit the U.S. shockingly hard. Amid a dismal economy, Richard Florida and Michael Seaman, in a publication by Brookings, estimated the losses within creative industries at 2.7 million jobs. In the fine and performing arts, roughly half of all jobs evaporated. The emotional tenor of the Trump years has not exactly been a gift to the arts either. By late 2016, it was common to see artists confess that the work that once gave their lives meaning now felt gratuitous, if not impossible. Those who did not confront the moment could not carve out much nuance with the blunt weapon of rage. It is not that we've been starved for good art, yet the cultural realm suffered from a Trump obsession fed by the president's flouting of the norms that once made it possible for private citizens to forget about the government for full hours at a time. We got more ugly portraits, more mouth-breathing impressions, more fake tan jokes. TV cashed in on polarization, offering a resistance-flavored The Handmaid's Tale. Sacha Baron Cohen's Who is America? And a short-lived Murphy Brown revival to some, SEAL Team. Live PD, and a short-lived Roseanne revival to others. Trump has haunted superhero flicks from Spider-Man, Far From Home, to Wonder Woman, 1984. J.D. Vance's divisive 2016 memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, was treated as a Rosetta Stone for understanding Trump's America. Ron Howard's divisive 2020 film adaptation bookended his tenure. Even comedy has had a rough few years. SNL's political sketches became reenactments of real events, with celebrities' stunt cast as the leads. A subgenre I think of as explainer comedy has taken off, exemplified by the didactic stylings of John Oliver, Hasan Minhaj, and Hannah Gadsby. Late-night hosts spent more time lamenting Trump's actions than lampooning him. One of the sharpest comedians of the Trump era, Michelle Wolf, skewered this trend in a Netflix talk show that was quickly canceled. Now we have Sarah Cooper, who lip-syncs Trump speeches to underline their self-evident madness. Not all political art, and pretty much all art is political, has devolved. The Trump years have given us sharp satires of generational wealth, succession, Knives Out, a Best Picture win for South Korea's Parasite. TV's expanded rapidly, making room for characters that society often ignores. See Pose, Watchmen, Vita, When They See Us. Childish Gambino's This Is America and Lana Del Rey's Norman Effing Rockwell sifted through the ashes of the American dream. My favorite novel of 2020 was Lydia Millett's A Children's Bible, which translates the plight of youth on a planet threatened by inequality and climate change into the language of myth. Yet so many of these works have roots that run deeper than Trump. It was the major progressive movements of the past decade, Black Lives Matter, Occupy, marriage equality, environmental activism, a newly visible transgender rights movement that primed the culture for art that was anti-racist, conservationist, critical of capitalist excesses, inclusive of all identities. Even hashtag MeToo and the Women's March, two responses to Trump's mistreatment of women, built on the foundation of Obama-era pop feminism. Think of the indelible American art that preceded Trump's presidency. Books like George Saunders' 10th of December, Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts, Jesmyn Ward's Men We Reaped, and Paul Beatty's The Sellout. Movies and TV shows include Moonlight, Atlanta, Orange is the New Black, Enlightened, Tangerine, and The Leftovers. Albums from D'Angelo's Black Messiah to Mitski's Puberty 2 to Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly. And transformational works of art like Beyoncé's Lemonade and Kara Walker's A Subtlety. In his post-election polemic, New York's Assaults, hoped regime change would jar professionalized artists from being part and parcel of the career machine, because why should art want to serve consensus? But when I look back at the major artworks of the Obama years, I see the opposite of consensus. The experiences and ideas represented were simply too diverse to be homogeneous. Yet some of the period's prematurely post-racial output feels naive now. But most creators were simply exploring a wide range of topics, many of which had little to do with the president. Ironically, it is the Trump years that have yielded consensus art, art that glosses over ideological differences within and beyond the broad categories of right and left. A president who monopolized the public's attention also possessed the power to force the individual voice into a defensive crouch. Trump may have lit a fire under some artists, but the exhaustion, trauma, and precarity that characterized his tenure worked hard to extinguish it. Although periods of social upheaval inform art, that is not the same as nurturing it. The Crusades had to end for the Renaissance to begin. When the cultural sphere expands, when human beings have the mental energy to exercise their imaginations, when speech is free but not weaponized in the service of hate, when the range of perspectives that can be expressed in relatively safety broadens, that is when art flourishes. The transition that is imminent will be neither instantaneous nor easy. COVID has ensured that the early Biden years will be some of the toughest in our history. No one's granting artists leave to go back to brunch, metaphorically speaking, if that is where they ever were. It will take time to shake the psychological tics of making art in the age of Trump, to stop framing every work as a response to him. But eventually the Cheeto dust will dissipate and the view will start to clear. Time off books. Gatsby Revisited by Annabelle Guterman. There's a photo here of a young man in profile. He's dressed well in a tweed-looking suit. His hair is very neatly combed back in another style of another era. It appears he's wearing a shirt and tie with this tweedy suit, and he's reading an open book. The caption reads, "While the Great Gatsby is his most famous work today, Fitzgerald died believing it was one of his lesser books," implying the portrait is that of F. Scott Fitzgerald. In 1925, Charles Scribner's Sons published F. Scott Fitzgerald's third novel, The Great Gatsby. In 1940, Fitzgerald died of a heart attack at 44 years old. Gatsby sold fewer than 25,000 copies, and his last royalty check was $13.13. In 1945, more than 123,000 copies of the book were distributed to Army and Navy servicemen during World War II as part of the Armed Services Editions Program. In 1960, after the book sells 50,000 copies the year before, the New York Times revisits the work and calls it a classic of 20th century American fiction. In 1974, the third film adaptation, starring Robert Redford, Mia Farrow, and Sam Waterston, and directed by Jack Clayton, premieres. There's a black and white photo of that. It's from a party scene. The men are all dressed in white shirt and tails, and Mia Farrow is front and center in that delightful, shimmery flapper outfit, complete with cloche and small beaded bag hanging from her forearm. In 2013, the fourth and most recent movie adaptation, Baz Luhrmann's version, featuring Leonardo DiCaprio, Carey Mulligan, and Tobey Maguire, hits theaters. Again, it's a photo, this in color, a small glitzy still with three gentlemen and a lady taking the space. And in 2021, The Great Gatsby enters public domain in the U.S., opening the door to adaptations and future editions. Returning to the text, Gatsby revisited by Annabel Guterman. Between the glitzy parties, secret backstories, and climatic murder in F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic novel, The Great Gatsby, there's a tiny detail readers may have missed. Right before he gets in a car with antagonist Tom Buchanan, the ride that kicks off the novel's tragic end, narrator Nick Carraway realizes he's forgotten his own birthday. It is a detail that stuck with author Michael Ferris Smith when he reread the novel in his 40s and sparked a lingering question. What makes a man so detached from himself that he does not remember his own birthday? In Nick, N-I-C-K, Smith's prequel to The Great Gatsby, released January 5, the author explores Carraway's life before he arrives in Jay Gatsby's world in West Egg. Ruminating on his travels and search for home during and after serving in World War I, the timing of the prequel may seem strange, arriving 96 years after the original book's publication, but it is intentional. Smith's novel was published just days after Gatsby entered U.S. public domain, January 1. Literary works are protected from replication for a certain number of years, depending on when they came out. The copyright for Fitzgerald's classic novel of greed, desire, and betrayal has expired. So anyone can publish the book and adapt it without permission from his literary estate, which controlled the text for 80 years since his death. That freedom could yield works that add to Gatsby's legacy. See what Wide Sargasso Sea did for Jane Eyre. Or it could open the door to editions that change the text for the worse. It has almost the status of a holy work, and it is seen as embodying all kinds of things about American values and society, says literary scholar James L.W. West III. In 2008, West set out to restore the text to match Fitzgerald's original version as closely as possible, rejecting British isms and other changes, and the resulting edition, published in 2018, is considered by the estate to be the most authoritative. But now that the copyright's expired, he and other scholars are both trepidatious and curious about what may come. If I were a writer thinking about doing a prequel or a sequel, West says, I'd be pretty nervous about putting my prose style up against Fitzgerald's. For a book so celebrated, a sense of protectiveness is expected. Scribner reports it sold more than 20 million copies of its editions in North America alone. Far from a success when it was originally published in 1925, The Great Gatsby is one of the great American novels, adapted several times for stage and screen, adopted as shorthand in pop culture for the glamour of the Roaring Twenties, and recently recommended by former President Barack Obama as a book to help understand the complexities of America. It is required reading for students everywhere for a reason. It introduces them to a real master of the language, West says. When he first set out to write Nick in 2014, Smith, the author of five previous books, understood the weight of the project. But he could not shake his idea after connecting with the character through his own experiences living abroad and returning to find his sense of home changed. That line about Nick when he realizes that he's on the edge of a decade of loneliness really struck me, Smith says. He blocked out the possibilities of backlash from those who might describe taking on Fitzgerald's characters as sacrilege, and did not tell his agent or editor about Nick until he finished writing it. So when he turned in his manuscript in 2015, he received unpleasant news. He would have to wait 6 years for the Gatsby copyright to expire or risk legal consequences. But he admits, if I had known, I would have probably procrastinated. In addition to projects like Nick, Gatsby fans can expect many more new editions of the original book. Author Min Jin Lee and cultural critic Wesley Morris are both writing new introductions to the text. And an illustrated edition from Black Dog and Leventhal, also published January 5, features the flashy iconography of the era. Some might view the freedom to explore the story as an opportunity to address issues like Fitzgerald's flat depiction of women, anti-Semitic descriptions, and lack of character diversity. In the UK, where the copyright expired in 2011, a Bristol theatre company will premiere a socially distanced adaptation with two women telling the story as soon as it's safe to do so. The production's director, Tom Brennan, found there was a lot to work with in the novel's details. When you read the book, there's an unreliable narrator who is a dude that talks about women in a particular way, Brennan says, adding that the company is studying the book's female characters in particular. West is intrigued by what a playwright could do by shifting perspectives. What if that book had been told by Daisy or Jordan Baker? Or Myrtle Wilson, he asks. What makes The Great Gatsby so beloved is neither its plot nor its characters. It is not a particularly original story, says Jackson R. Breyer, president of the F. Scott Fitzgerald Society, which promotes and celebrates the author's work. It's the way Fitzgerald tells the story and the beauty of the style. He likens the experience of reading Gatsby to that of poetry, where each phrase is deliberate and echoes concerns about what may happen when anyone can edit the text. It is like if you took a Robert Frost poem and put a wrong word somewhere, Breyer says. It probably would not change the overall meaning of the poem, but it would not be the poem. Even so, Breyer's hopeful that people will now revisit the novel, perhaps for the first time since school. He remembers how his own interpretation of Gatsby changed. He first read it as a tragic love story and later realized that it interrogates the constraints of social class. And he finds Gatsby's relevance unwavering today. We are living in a time where the social barriers to getting ahead in America seem more stringent than ever before. West adds that the book has a staying power that's buoyed its success, describing it as one of those remarkable literary works that seems to adapt to its times. The nature of copyright law means that all literary works will eventually enter public domain. The Great Gatsby, certainly not alone in that regard. Works by Edith Wharton, Agatha Christie, and thousands of other writers entered public domain in 2019. Next year, William Faulkner's and Ernest Hemingway's first novels will join Gatsby. The expiration of copyright's inevitable, and it certainly will mean that The Great Gatsby now belongs to the people, West said. Whether the book will retain its hold on the American imagination or whether it will take new directions with so many editions, I am curious to see. Time off the movies. There's a photo here of a scantily clad woman running away from what appears to be the dome of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. Now, by scantily clad, I have to say, it looks like a one-piece bathing suit with kind of a skirt attached. And she's also wearing metallic-colored gauntlets and a metallic-colored headband that surrounds and goes underneath her long black hair. The one-piece-looking bathing suit is, in fact, crimson red with all kinds of metallic zigzags and other appendages, I guess, and accessories attached to it. I don't know if there's a knife hanging from her hip, but there's something there. review. Wonder Woman, 1984, could be more wondrous, by Stephanie Sakaric. Wonder Woman, 1984, is not great, and it is not terrible. It has simply arrived at a time when people need a diversion, and the studio behind the film, Warner Brothers, made the responsible decision to release it in U.S. theaters and on HBO Max the same day, a strategy that will apply to all their 2021 releases. Watching at home is a safe option at a precarious time. It's also a boon for large families. Once you subscribe, you can just park the whole gang around the TV. Yet it is fair to ask, even if you're watching on the biggest TV, Wonder Woman 1984, is it a less exhilarating experience than it would be in a theater? Although Warner Brothers' decision was in this case a practical one, it does point the way toward new models of distribution. And while cinema nerds are forever arguing the merits of seeing everything on the big screen, guilty as charged, there is little doubt that blockbuster entertainments lose something on the small one. Who wants to be underwhelmed by a superhero? The small screen may not be the greatest friend to Wonder Woman 1984, directed by Patty Jenkins. In this film's predecessor, the 2017 Wonder Woman, also directed by Jenkins and also starring Gal Gadot, that's G-A-L space G-A-D-O-T, in the title role, Amazonian Princess Diana Prince in her superhero guise stopped World War I and also fell in love with the first man she ever met, sweet, brave American pilot Steve Trevor, Chris Pine. Wonder Woman 1984 finds Diana living in Washington, working as an anthropologist and archaeologist at the Smithsonian. Steve, the love of her life, is dead. In what may be the movie's best moment, Diana sits alone at an outdoor cafe table, and after ascertaining that no one's joining her, the waiter whisks the extra menu away. When you outlive the ones you love, being a superhero is not always so super. Diana does make a new friend when nerdy fellow anthropologist Barbara Minerva, Kristen Wiig, arrives at the museum. At the same time, a curious relic shows up in the collections, one with wish-granting properties. Diana benefits inadvertently from this stone's sacred hoo-ha. It brings Steve back to her. But its powers also wreak havoc when wannabe oil tycoon Maxwell Lord, Game of Thrones Pedro Pascal, gets a hold of it. Soon, there's a megalomaniacal nut job in the White House, as if that's never happened. As the world falls apart, Diana, armed with her zinger crown, must step in to save it. Gadot, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, again it's G-A-D-O-T, is a charming, vital presence. Yet as stunning as she looks in her lithe Wonder Woman garb, she's almost engaging. She is most engaging as Diana Prince. Her human weaknesses are her most compelling feature. But just being a woman is never enough for anybody. In addition to saving the world, Diana, as Wonder Woman, is frequently tasked with saving little girls from danger. She whisks them to safety with a wink, and they beam at her appreciatively, so grateful that at last they have a superhero of their own. Why do we always have to be reminded of Wonder Woman's purpose as a female-specific role model? Why can't she just be? The 2017 Wonder Woman held some promise that a new breed of woman-led superhero movies might be less formulaic. But now, in addition to swinging her magic lasso around, our heroine is saddled with a bunch of dull, lofty speeches. This apparently is the equality we fought for. Little girls may look up to Wonder Woman, but little girls also deserve better movies. As a mild amusement, Wonder Woman 1984 is perfectly suitable. But it's still okay to wish for less sanctimoniousness and more wonder. That holds true on the big screen for sure. On the small one, it may count double. Seven questions. This article, this column is by Abigail Abrams, and it features the photo of a woman. She's dressed in a dark-colored sheath. She has long, dark-colored hair flowing to her shoulders and beyond. She's smiling, but not with teeth, smiling at the camera. Alexis McGill Johnson, the Planned Parenthood president on racial equity, working with Biden, and the fight beyond Roe. Question, what are your top priorities for the Biden administration? On day one, an executive order that will demonstrate the administration's commitment to sexual and reproductive health care. That order to eliminate the global gag rule, keep medication abortion easier to access during the pandemic, and begin the process of rolling back harmful policies, like the Trump birth control rules that allow employers to essentially force their personal beliefs on employees. We are also working toward a budget that will eliminate the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits the use of federal funds to pay for most abortions. Question. Democrats did not do as well as expected in the House. How do you interpret the 2020 results? Answer. Over 7 million more Americans voted for Biden-Harris, and their victory was delivered by a coalition of young people, people of color, women, and black women, who have a very strong grasp of the various intersectional issues that face their communities, our communities. So that progressive coalition and the understanding of their lived experience should inform the Biden administration and the future DNC. Question, what do you think of Joe Biden's choice of Xavier Becerra to lead the Department of Health and Human Services? Answer, it's tremendously exciting. Becerra, that's B-E-C-E-R-R-A, is a staunch sexual and reproductive health champion. He understands how urgent it is for us to tackle inequity in our health care system. How does Donald Trump's appointing Justice Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court affect the future of reproductive rights? Answer, we now know that we're long past the point where we can rely on the courts as a backstop. So we are going to continue to work with our partners to elect champions up and down the ballot, because we know that on the federal level there is work that has to be done, but that a lot of the fights are going to be happening in the states. Question, during the presidential primary, Senator Kamala Harris proposed a law that would protect the right to abortion nationwide. With Harris as vice president, is that something Planned Parenthood would pursue? Answer, even with Roe v. Wade in place, access to abortion is still limited. As our reproductive justice colleagues always say, Roe is on the floor, not the ceiling. We need to think about that. How do we go beyond Roe to fulfill the promise of safe, legal abortion for all? That is not a single policy solution. You know, it is about the right, but also the access. Question. Harris also made other issues of women's health a focus during her campaign for president. How will having her in the White House impact your work? Answer. I really value her leadership on issues like maternal mortality, which is part of sexual and reproductive health care. With all of these appointments and conversations, I think it is giving us a lot of hope about the ways in which this administration is using the power of its personnel appointments to demonstrate and signal the direction of policy that isn't neat. All of these agencies impact us. And the final question, how is Planned Parenthood thinking about its own work in the context of health equity and racial justice? Answer, Planned Parenthood is a 104-year-old organization. The reckoning has hit us as well. It has been very powerful to lean into the work and to think about, with the patient at the center of everything we do, how we develop a stronger intersectional claim that allows us to deliver care with the values that we espouse. The race to save the world, the remarkable scientific discoveries behind the new COVID-19 vaccines by Walter Isaacson, Two photos, the same as on the cover, BioNTech co-founders Drs. Ugor Sahin and Özlem Türeci in a BioNTech lab in Mainz, Germany, January 3. This is a lengthy article that may be abridged for time purposes. No, the doctor snapped, look at me. I had been staring at her in the eyes, as she had ordered, but when a doctor on my other side began jabbing me with a needle, I started to turn my head. Don't look at it, the first doctor said. I obeyed. This was in early August in New Orleans, where I signed up to be a participant in the clinical trial for the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine. It was a blind study, which meant I was not supposed to know whether I'd gotten the placebo or the real vaccine. I asked the doctor if I would really be able to tell by looking at the syringe. Probably not, she answered, but we want to be careful. This is very important to get right. I became a vaccine guinea pig because, in addition to wanting to be useful, I had a deep interest in the wondrous new roles now being played by RNA, the genetic material that is at the heart of new types of vaccines, cancer treatments, and gene editing tools. I was writing a book on the Berkeley biochemist Jennifer Doudna. She was a pioneer in determining the structure of RNA, which helped her and her doctoral advisor figure out how it could be the origin of all life on this planet. Then she and a colleague invented an RNA-guided gene editing tool, which won them the 2020 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. The tool is based on a system that bacteria use to fight viruses. Bacteria develop clustered repeated sequences in their DNA, known as CRISPRs, that can remember dangerous viruses and then deploy RNA-guided scissors to destroy them. In other words, it's an immune system that can adapt itself to fight each new wave of viruses, just what we humans need. Now, with the recently approved Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and a similar one from Moderna being slowly rolled out across the U.S. and Europe, RNA's been deployed to make a whole new type of vaccine that will, when it reaches enough people, change the course of the pandemic. Up until last year, vaccines had not changed very much, at least in concept, for more than two centuries. Most have been modeled on the discovery made in 1796 by the English doctor Edward Jenner, who noticed many milkmaids were immune to smallpox. They'd all been infected by a form of pox that afflicts cows, but's relatively harmless to humans. And Jenner surmised the cowpox had given them immunity to smallpox. So he took some pus from a cowpox blister, rubbed it into scratches he made in the arm of his gardener's 8-year-old son, and then, this was in the days before bioethics panels, exposed the kid to smallpox, and he did not become ill. Before then, inoculations were done by giving patients a small dose of the actual smallpox virus, hoping they'd get a mild case and then be immune. Jenner's great advance was to use a related but relatively harmless virus. Ever since, vaccinations have been based on the idea of exposing a patient to a safe facsimile of a dangerous virus or other germ. This is intended to kick the person's adaptive immune system into gear. When it works, the body produces antibodies that will, sometimes for many years, fend off any infection if the real germ attacks. One approach is to inject a safely weakened version of the virus. These can be good teachers because they look very much like the real thing. The body responds by making antibodies for fighting them, and the immunity can last a lifetime. Albert Sabin used this approach for the oral polio vaccine in the 1950s, and that is the way we now fend off measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox. At the same time Sabin was trying to develop a vaccine based on a weakened polio virus, Jonas Salk succeeded with a safer approach, using a killed or inactivated virus. This type of vaccine can still teach a person's immune system how to fight off the live virus, but is less likely to cause serious side effects. Two Chinese companies, Sinopharm and Sinovac, have used this approach to develop vaccines for COVID-19 that are now in limited use in China, the UAE, and Indonesia. Another traditional approach is to inject a subunit of the virus, such as one of the proteins that are on the virus's coat. The immune system will then remember these, allowing the body to mount a quick and robust response when it encounters the actual virus. The vaccine against the hepatitis B virus, for example, works this way. Using only a fragment of the virus means they're safer to inject into a patient and easier to produce, but they're often not as good at producing long-term immunity. The Maryland-based biotech Novavax is in late-stage clinical trials for COVID-19 vaccine using this approach, and it's the basis for one of two vaccines already being rolled out in Russia. The plague year of 2020 will be remembered as the time when these traditional vaccines were supplanted by something fundamentally new, genetic vaccines, which deliver a gene or piece of genetic code into human cells. The genetic instructions then cause the cells to produce, on their own, safe components of the target virus in order to stimulate the patient's immune system. The ability to code messenger RNA to do our bidding will transform medicine. As with the COVID vaccines, we can instruct mRNA to cause our cells to make antigens, molecules that stimulate our immune system that could protect us against many viruses, bacteria, or other pathogens that cause infectious disease. In addition, mRNA could in the future be used, as BioNTech and Moderna are pioneering, to fight cancer. Harnessing a process called immunotherapy, the mRNA can be coded to produce molecules that will cause the body's immune system to identify and kill cancer cells. RNA can also be engineered, as Jennifer Doudna and others discovered, to target genes for editing. CRISPR gene editing technology came from understanding the way that bacteria use snippets of RNA to guide enzymes to destroy viruses. Great inventions come from understanding basic science. Nature is beautiful that way. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.